So, it is announced that the subject of this seminar is play and survival. Are they in necessary contradiction? And we are going to examine the subject in the context of Christian, Islamic, Buddhist, Jewish, Hindu, Taoist, and scientific naturalism. Living, it seems to me, is a spontaneous process. The Chinese term for nature is zhiran, which means that which is so of itself, that which happens. It's very curious, because of our grammar, that we speak in almost all standard average European languages, we are unable to imagine a process which happens by itself. Because every verb must have a noun as its subject, a director. And we think nothing is in order unless someone or something orders it, unless there's somebody in charge. And so to us, the idea of a process of nature which happens of itself, by itself, is frightening, because there seems to be no authority. And therefore, in the United States, we are in a serious social and political conflict, because we think that we ought to be living in a republic, but the great majority of citizens believe that the universe is a monarchy. And you cannot be a loyal citizen of the United States unless you believe that a republic is the best form of government. So we're always seeking for a monarch, for someone else upon whom to push the responsibility. We won't take it ourselves. We're always complaining that where we are is the result of our past. My mother and father were neurotic, you know, and therefore they made me neurotic. And their fathers and mothers were neurotic and made them neurotic. And so it goes back to Adam and Eve. And you remember what happened in the Garden of Eden. God set a trap by saying, there is that specific tree and you mustn't eat the fruit of it. If he had really not wanted them to eat the fruit, he wouldn't have said anything about it. But by drawing attention to it in this way, it was obvious they were going to eat it. So when he saw Adam looking guilty, and he said, Adam, hast thou eaten of the fruit of the tree whereof I told thee thou shouldst not eat? And he said, the woman you gave me, she tempted me and I did eat. And he looked very severely at Eve and said, Eve, have you eaten of the fruit of the tree whereof I told thee thou shouldst not eat? And she said, the serpent beguiled me. Passing the buck, you see. And God looked at the serpent. And this isn't written in the Bible, but they winked at each other. Because they had planned long in advance that the universe was not going to be a merely obedient arrangement. Well, I, God, say you shall do thus and so, and you will automatically do it. There would be no fun in that, because there would be no surprises. So it is the Hebrew theology that God put into the heart of Adam at the creation a thing called the Yetzer Hara, which means the wayward spirit. Just the kind of little, just like you when you make a stew, you put some salt in it. You don't want the whole stew to be salt, but just a touch. See? So God, in creating Adam, put just a touch of wickedness in him, so that something surprising and different would happen, which God would not be able to prognosticate. Now this is very important. You see, what we're going to talk about mainly is our sense of identity. Our sense of alienation and the complications we put ourselves into by regarding survival as a duty. These all connect together. You may not see the connection immediately. But if you imagine yourself in the position of being God, in the literal popular sense of God the Father Almighty, that means you're a male chauvinist pig. And you're in charge of everything. You know all pasts, you know all futures. You're completely in control of the cosmos. You have absolute power. And you're bored to death. So you say to yourself, man, get lost. I want a surprise. And here you are. Only you mustn't admit it. The hallmark of insanity is to know that you're God. That's absolute taboo. Not only in the Christian religion, because Jesus got crucified for knowing that. And the Christians said, okay, Jesus was God, but let it stop right there. Nobody else. But the gospel was the revelation to us all that the Hindus knew forever. Tattvamasi, you're it. And if Jesus had lived in India, they would have congratulated him for finding out instead of crucifying him. There have been many people in India who knew they were God in disguise. Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Ramana Maharshi, Sri Krishna himself, Buddha, everybody, they discovered it. Because it's not an exclusive claim, I alone am that, but you all are. And as I look into your eyes, I see the universe looking back at me. So we're in a situation where it's a taboo. We mustn't admit that we know who we are. So as to have the thrill, that sort of self-goosing effect of feeling lost, feeling strange, feeling alone, of not belonging. And we say in popular speech that I came into this world. You did nothing of the kind. You came out of it. Just in the same way as the fruit comes out of the tree, the egg from the chicken, and the baby from the womb. We are symptomatic of the universe. We are its nerve endings. Just as in the retina, there are myriads of nerve endings. So all of us are nerve endings of the universe. And there are many of us, so that the universe's point of view of itself will not be prejudiced. It'll be many-sided. And so, fascinating things happen. We want to find out what it is that's going on. And we look with telescopes to find the farthest out things, and with microscopes to find the farthest in things. And the more powerful our instruments become, the more the world runs away from us. As our telescopes become more powerful, the universe expands. Because it's ourselves running away from ourselves. The more accurate our physics becomes, and we investigate the nucleus. Some years ago, we thought we had it. We found a thing called the atom. And that was that. Then, whoops, an electron turned up. Then, bang, there was a proton. And then, when we got out of those, there came out all kinds of things. Mesons, antimatter, and it got worse and worse and worse because we got sharper. See? And so we are a self-observing system, which is like the snake, the Ouroboros, that bites its own tail and endeavors to swallow itself to find out what it is. It's like the whole quest of who am I? I would like to see me. But look at your head. Can you see it? It's completely invisible. And it isn't black. It isn't there's a dark spot behind my eyes. It isn't even blurry. It's plain nowhere. And thereby hangs a tale. Most of us assume, as a matter of common sense, that space is nothing. This is not important. It has no energy. But as a matter of fact, space is the basis of existence. How could you have stars without space? Stars shine out of space. Something comes out of nothing. And in just the same way, if you listen in an unprejudiced way with your ears to find out, you see, I've got these sense organs here, and I'm going to trust them to find out what is going on, what really is. And you listen. And you hear all these sounds coming out of silence. It's amazing. Silence is the origin of sound, just as space is the origin of stars, just as woman is the origin of man. She is black. So, also, if you listen and pay real attention to what is, you will discover that there is no past, no future, and no one listening. You can't hear yourself listening. So you live in the eternal now, and you are that, Tattvamasi. And it's really extremely simple. That's the way it is. Now then, I started out by saying, survival, going on living, is a spontaneous process. Love is the same. But the trouble is that when we were children, our elders and betters told us that it was our duty to love them. God said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind, and thy neighbor as thyself. And so our mothers said to us, you must have a bowel movement after breakfast. Try to go to sleep. Take that look off your face. Stop pouting. Oh, you're blushing. Pull yourself together. Pay attention. And all these are commands. The basic rule is as follows. You are required to do that which will be acceptable only if you do it voluntarily. That's the formula. You must love me, and it's a double bind. And everybody is completely mixed up because of this. So, you know, this stupid story I often tell. The husband says to wife, darling, do you really love me? And she says, well, I'm trying my best to do so. And nobody wants that answer. They want to be told, I love you so much I could eat you. I can't help loving you. I'm your hopeless victim. So, we are under the compulsion to go on living. You must go on living. It's your duty. You know, get tired of living and scared of dying. You must go on. Why? Well, I have dependents. I have children. And I have to go on working to support them. But all that does is to teach them the same attitude. So they will go dragging along to support their children, who will in turn learn it from them to go dragging along and fighting this thing out. And so I watch with total amazement the goings on of the world. See, all these people commuting, driving cars like maniacs to get to an office where they're going to make money. For what? So that they can go on doing the same thing. And very few of them enjoy it. Sensible people get paid for playing. That's the art of life. But the whole idea of struggling and beating your brains out in order to go on living is completely ridiculous. Camus, at the beginning of his book, The Myth of Sisyphus, made this very sensible statement. He said, the only real, deep philosophical question is whether or not to commit suicide. Think that one over. Must you go on? Because it would be so simple to stop it. No problems. Nobody around to regret that it wasn't going on any longer. What is it like? Death. To go to sleep and never wake up. Oh, that's terrible. To be in the dark forever. It wouldn't be like that. It wouldn't be like being buried alive forever. It would be as if you never had existed. And not only that you never had existed, but that nothing at all had ever existed. And that would be just the way it was before you were born. Which is another way of demonstrating how something comes out of nothing. Nothing is the essential prerequisite of something. See? They're back and front of the same coin, as the Chinese say, the yang and the yin of it. So, like you have an invisible head, your ultimate reality, the ground of your being, is nothing. Sunyata, as the Buddhists call it, the void, which is space, which is consciousness, which is that in which we live and move and have our being, God, the great void. And fortunately, there's no way of knowing what it is. Because if we could know what it is, we would be bored. The little function of interest is mystery. There was a great Dutch philosopher by the name of Van der Leeuw who said the mystery of life is not a problem to be solved, but a reality to be experienced. And fortunately, you see, we have in the middle of all consciousness a perpetual problem, a perpetual question that we don't know what it is that is. Therefore, life remains interesting. So we're always trying to find out, but it won't yield the answer. Because reality, when you say, what is reality? The only way to answer the question, what, is by classification. Is you is, or is you ain't? Is you male, is you female? Are you a Republican or a Democrat? Are you animal, vegetable, or mineral? Thinker, tailor, soldier, sailor, rich man, poor man, beggar, man, thief. We put you in a class. But what it is that fundamentally is cannot be classified. So nobody knows what it is, and you can't really ask the question in a meaningful way, what is reality? Now, there are many theories, philosophical theories, about what reality is. Some people say, well, reality is, there's material. And you know, there's a thing called stuff. And philosophers, because they're always lecturing in front of tables in the university, you know, they always bang the table and say, now, does this table have reality or not? See? And they bang the table. When Dr. Johnson heard about Bishop Berkeley's theory that everything is in fact mental, he disproved it by kicking a stone and said, surely, to every person of common sense, this stone is really material and physical. See? Whereas on the other hand, more subtle thinkers say, no, there is nothing material. It's all a mental construction. The whole world is a phenomenon of consciousness. When in Bishop Berkeley's time, they didn't know much about neurology. Now we know a great deal about neurology, and we can state the same position in a much more sophisticated way. That the structure of your nervous system is what determines the world that you see. In other words, in a world of no eyes, the sun would not be light. In a world of no tactile nerve ends, fire would not be hot. In a world of no muscles, rocks would not be heavy. In a world with no soft skin, the rocks wouldn't be hard. That's all relationship. So in this, the old question, when a tree falls in a forest and nobody is listening, does it or doesn't it make a noise? The answer is perfectly simple. Noise is a relationship between vibrations in the ear, in the air, and eardrums. Look, if I hit a drum which has no skin on it, no matter how hard I hit it, it won't make a sound. So the air can go vibrating forever, but if there's no drum and no auditory nervous system, there's no noise, because the noise is a relationship. So we, by virtue of our physical structure, evoke the world from vibrations that would otherwise be void. So you're creating the world. But you're also in the world. See? Your body, your nervous system is something in the external world. You're in my external world, I'm in your external world. See? So it's an egg and hen situation. Perfectly fascinating. So we are, from a very hard-boiled neurological point of view, evoking the world in which we live. And we are something that the world is doing. After all, what you are, from the point of view of physics, the physicist will explain that you are a buzzing of electronic substances and processes, just like anything else. It's all one jazz. But marvelous, because it is aware of itself through you. So, existence, however, has two aspects. We'll call one of them on and the other off. Because all existence is a vibration. If I am sitting next to a girl in the movies, and I feel attracted to her, and I put my hand on her knee, and I leave it there, she will notice the first, but she will become unaware of it if I don't move my hand. So instead of just leaving my hand there, I start stroking her, or patting her knee, see? Then I go on and off, on and off, and she realizes that I'm paying attention. See? So everything that is happening to us is going yang 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 yang. But you see, take with the sense of sight, the vibration of light is so fast that the retina doesn't register the off. It retains the impression of the on. And so with our eyes, we see things as relatively stable. But if we close our eyes and listen, we hear on and off, especially in the low registers of sound. See, in the high register, whoop, you can't hear the off, you hear the on. But when you get in the low register, you see, you hear the on and off, the vibration. Now, actually, everything that is physically existing is a throbbing, because it is positive and negative electricity. Incidentally, Read the article on electricity in the 14th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Just the first two paragraphs. Learned scientific article with all kinds of formula and stuff, but it starts out with pure metaphysics. Electricity, says the author, is an absolute. We do not know anything else that is like it. It is a fundamental of the universe. He's talking pure theology. So, this is it, you see. The thing, it goes on and off. Male and female, yang and yin. Now you see it, now you don't. Well, we've been brought up to think that with our 19th century background, to think that this energy which goes on and off is inherently stupid, that it is a mechanical thing. Freud called it libido. Ernst Haeckel called it blind energy. And therefore we feel that we as human beings are flukes. A million monkeys working on a million typewriters for a million years might statistically type the Bible. Of course, thereafter, as soon as they got to the end of it, they would dissolve again into nonsense. But we feel, we've been brought up to feel, you see, that we are flukes in that sense. We are simply accidents. And that is alienation, you see. That is the great problem. And it seems to me completely obvious that we are not accidents. When we say, you know, you're nothing but a little bacterium that crawls around on a ball of rock that circles an unimportant star on the outer fringes of a minor galaxy. Now, why do people say things like that? I'll tell you why. They want to say, I'm tough. I look at the facts, and they're hard facts. The idea that there's somebody up there who cares is for little old ladies. Weaklings. And I think this universe is a bunch of shit. So I'm a real realistic guy. See? That's the message you get from these people. See? Always look in a person's philosophy as to what he or she is saying about himself. Because your philosophy is your role, the game you put on. Now, I admit, you see, my philosophy is my game I put on. It's my big act. Well, I think if I'm going to put on a big act at all, I'm going to put on the biggest one I can put on. And say, to hell with all that nonsense. I know very well that although I'm impermanent, which is just the way I want it, because I hell wouldn't like to be permanent. What a bore that would be. But I am an impermanent manifestation of the witch than which there is no witcher, of the root and ground of the universe, which, as St. Thomas Aquinas would say, is what all men call God, Atman, Brahman. And I think it's fun to know that. Not merely as a theory, but as a positive sensation, which you can actually feel. And so, therefore, my function in conducting the seminar with you is, if at all possible, that you should share this feeling. And not need any more psychotherapy, not need any more gurus, and not need any more religion. Just take off. Except, I mean, there is something called religion for kicks. My favorite church is the Russian Orthodox Cathedral in Paris, where they really live it up. They have gold, incense, icons, masses of candles, and gorgeous music. And priests come out from the secret sanctuary, we know, behind the royal doors, the iconostasis divides the main church from the inner sanctum. And the doors open, and somebody comes out looking like God the Father, you know, and beautiful robes. And he sings, and the choir goes, Ospodi pomilu. And it goes on and on and on, and when you get bored, you go across the street to a vodka shop where they sell vodka and caviar, blini, bublitschki, piroshki, and everything, you know? And everybody lives it up, then they go back to church again. anyway, that kind of religion is like dancing. It's a joyous expression. And it's not telling God what to do, because all this thing is in Old Church Slavonic, which nobody understands. And it's just making great and glorious noises. This is essentially music. So, now what I would like to suggest is that we have a brief intermission so that you can stretch for about 5 minutes. And then I would, instead of monologuing at you, would like to talk with you, have your reactions, questions. Don't feel that you just have to ask questions if you want to react in any way. The whole point of a seminar, incidentally, is that it is a free-for-all. Instead of a big public lecture where, you know, it has to be restricted, so that I can give as much of myself to you as possible. So please help yourselves.